This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer show. On today's episode, we are talking phobias. What are you afraid of? And could some CBT help you overcome it? Marking World Africa Day with food and fashion, and talking burnout. A study revealed the UAE is in a state of stress. So what's stressing us out? What's happening in our bodies? And men and women experiencing it differently. Also talking about the impact of oxygen on our bodies in some very extreme chambers, and exploring that relationship between family and nanny, how to be the best employer, and what to do when things get a bit bumpy on that road. Plus, we were speaking to a young eco-warrior who's passionate about educating us about greenwashing. A Cigna 360 Global Wellbeing Survey revealed that stress levels in the UAE are sky high. Around 98% of respondents in the region claiming to experience at least one symptom of burnout. That's against 94% globally. So what's going on? How can we understand what's happening in our bodies and our brains? And ultimately, maybe take our score down a little. On hand to help is Ben Hardy. He's a clinical professor of organisational behaviour at London Business School. Ben, what's your number today?
Oh, I think I'm actually not too bad. I think
even
I'm
though you're on live radio?
I know. Yeah, but I also flew in the day before yesterday, so I'm up. You know, I'm quite relaxed because there's a certain amount of tiredness overlaid on top of it.
I get that. I'm all right today, I have
Are you good?
To say. Yeah, I'm all right. I've had a couple of late nights.
Are you going to put a number on it?
I'd say I'm a 4.
Yeah.
That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's very good.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. What is organisational behaviour? Tell us a little bit about that as a topic before we delve into what on earth is going on.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. So organisational behaviour is really looking at how people behave. I mean, it does what it says on the tin, how people behave in organisations. So we look at things at a kind of individual level, motivation. We look at decision making, things like that, influencing other people. But also at an organisational level, stuff like culture, networks within organizations, communication. So it's quite a big topic.
And also then we throw some surveys at you, and that's what I want to help us to understand today.
Yeah.
You know, talking about 98% of respondents in the region saying they've had at least one symptom of burnout. Tell us a little bit about those numbers, because this is compared to 94%. These seem like very high numbers around the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a sort of interesting question about, should we have no stress at all in our lives?
No, we wouldn't get anything done.
Well, I think that's important. And are we picking up, when we're looking at one or two things, is that what we're picking up?
Mm-hmm.
We need a little bit. And there's an old study going back to 1908 by a couple of people, Yerkes and Dodson. And, you know, no stress, quite low performance. Super high stress, quite low performance. You need a bit in the middle. It's one of those inverted U-type graphs.
Mm-hmm.
So you need a bit of something to kind of get you going.
Let's talk about some of these symptoms that people are talking about. So looking at the Cigna survey, what are some of the symptoms of burnout that the 98% have said they've definitely encountered?
So, I mean, looking at one of the things we see people having a kind of lack of enthusiasm for work. Sometimes we see people who are turning work over in their minds all the time. They never kind of switch off.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of constellation of factors. And quite often, I mean, you may pick up, for example, turning work over. It may just be there's a difficult problem.
And again, that's a way of kind of working through it. Maybe not in the most productive way, but, you know, turning your attentions to it with a goal in mind.
Yeah.
It's when it's not productive that it becomes problematic, presumably.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an interesting distinction to be made between kind of acute stress.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the stress of coming on a radio show, and chronic stress, which is where it's day in, day out. And actually they have different effects on the body.
What happens?
So we did some work looking at, I'll back up a little bit, only because we did a really interesting study where we fed people cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So you'd come into the lab. You can measure cortisol by getting people to dribble into
it's
a little
a saliva
pot.
Test.
Yeah, salivary cortisol, which actually mirrors blood cortisol levels quite well.
Okay.
So you dribble into a little pot. We'd measure your resting level. We'd weigh you, and then we'd give you a load of cortisol.
In what format? Is it like
pills?
Really?
Pills, yeah, and it's absorbed really quickly. And so you take that, and then when you'd first come in, we'd get you to do a kind of risk-taking task. And then after you'd taken the pills, about 3 hours afterwards, we'd get you to do the task again. So we could compare you without pills, you with pills. We then got people to take them for a whole week.
Oh, crikey.
And it was very interesting. The results were actually the one-off dose, the acute dose, so that just that day doesn't make any difference to decision-making. But what we found after a week was it makes a big difference. So people take a lot less risk, which kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're stressed, you focus down on the thing and you don't, it's much harder to kind of look around and be expansive.
Can I ask, was there any gender difference in terms of whether what happens in the body or indeed behaviour and brain between men and women?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously sizable gender differences in hormones that just run on more or less broadly different. There's different emphasis on different hormones. Women have got testosterone, men have got some of the others, but they're obviously in different quantities. But what we found in terms of cortisol, that everyone took less risk. But one of the sexes was to be honest, a bit volatile and tended to overreact to bits of information. And then the other one was female. So it was the men that overreacted to snippets of information. Good news.
Yes.
You know, oh, great. Bad news. Oh, no, we're doomed.
Okay.
Women were much more even. So there's one of the things we were looking at was we were interested in what had happened after the last financial crash in the UK. And one of the questions we asked was, did there ought to be more gender diversity?
In order to offset some of these variables.
Absolutely. Yeah, because that would give a different kind of flavour to the market.
That's
and perhaps more stability.
Really, really fascinating. Now, you've said that bad things aren't stressful, but uncertain things are. What do you mean by that, Ben?
Yeah, no. So I always used to think that, I mean, we all kind of think that bad things are stressful. But what we found, actually, it was my boss who, when we did the cortisol studies, he'd done a previous study where he went to a trading floor, got traders to dribble in pots 3 times a day. And he looked at you could see how much money they'd made. And what he found was that if they lost a load of money, their cortisol levels went up but came down again.
Mm-hmm.
What really stuck their cortisol levels up was volatility in the market. And if you can imagine, it's a bit like, imagine you've got a kind of trading position and you're suddenly either in the money or out of the money. You know, we're going to get a new kitchen, I'm going to be fired. We're going to get a new kitchen, I'm going to be fired. That kind of joggling around is stressful.
Which is interesting now that, can I say we're out of the pandemic? I know a few people with COVID now. But in terms of that uncertainty over the last few years, it's going to be really interesting down the line to be able to zoom out and look back. But even now, in 2023, what are some of your big observations when it comes to stress and certainly in the workplace as a result of that uncertainty?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of geopolitical uncertainty. Obviously, there's war, there's what's
politics,
happening with the stock market, all the kind of things we know about. And they produce uncertainty. And actually, we have to bear in mind, we've had, certainly in many parts of the West, huge, long, long periods of not very much happening. Compared to not our parents, but our parents' parents. Yeah.
It's interesting. I think I was speaking to a disaster kind of management specialist recently, and she would go in after, oh my goodness, you know, after the London bombings, you know, she was involved in 9/11, and she was talking about the West in particular. She's like, we've been in a state of perma-crisis for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And that compounds. It compounds in the body and it compounds in society and how we react. But we're going to zoom out now from society and we're going to talk about people next. Joining us in the studio now is Ben Hardy. He's a clinical professor of organisational behaviour at the London Business School. Ben Hardy is with us in the studio, clinical professor of organisational behaviour at the London Business School, and we're unpacking a survey by Cigna, the 360 Global Wellbeing Survey, revealed that stress levels in the UAE are sky high. Around 98% of respondents in the region claiming to experience at least one symptom of burnout. That's against 94% globally. So it sounds like the rest of the world it's not exactly chilling in a hammock either, Ben.
No, it's not all gravy.
So let's talk about what is stressing us out. And are any of these issues kind of modern phenomena? You know, is it the same thing as 50 years ago or even, 5,000?
Yeah, it's hard to know because it's, you know, we always look and say, oh, it's modern things, and I'm never quite sure. But I think there are some things. We're able to compare ourselves a lot more to other people through things like social media. We're probably a bit more distanced from other people because we'll WhatsApp them or we'll, you know, communicate in some much narrower bandwidth rather than, you know, going out for a meal or, I mean, in the UK case, we'd go off to the pub or these kinds of forums, or we go and join a club or something. Mm-hmm. That seems to be more fragmented and there's a lot of stuff around that. So I wonder if we're not getting, we've got this situation where we're comparing to other people and coming up short against their beautifully curated lives. You know, behind the scenes, of course, we know it's often very different. Mm-hmm. But then the other side of it is we've got no real way of processing that other than through little snippets of text. So
some disconnect going on.
Yeah,
as well.
I think I wonder if that's a cause. I don't know.
And then you were talking about uncertainty as well, and that can be job insecurity, financial, you know, also, I mean, my goodness, it just goes on. So let's talk about then when you feel like you might be in danger of getting burnt out, which is, we know, is incredibly dangerous to your body and your mind. What are some of those signs, and ultimately, what can you do to then hopefully make that oil tanker do a U-turn?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's a really good question. Do you remember we talked earlier about the kind of inverted U shape? And the point is, when you were heading down the kind of downhill slope, what's interesting is often we're not very good at recognizing it. Mm-hmm. I personally find that I am usually about 6 weeks too late.
Right.
I'll go, oh, I'm burnt out. But actually, what I should have done is done something 6 weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. So I think, because of that, it's worth trying to think about who can help you. We have certain things that kind of predictably tell us we're going off the edge. I have a particular thing where I get a song in my head and I have to listen to it all the time.
Any particular song, Ben?
It's been all kinds of stuff. And to be honest, the list is too embarrassing even to share with you. But
isn't that interesting? That's your tell.
That's for me. And when I know that's happening, I think, ah. Apparently, if I talk to my students about this, this is quite weird. But everyone has these things. And it's friends and family can help enormously because they can just spot when they're actually in a way more sensitive than you are. And they can see when you're just starting to head over that edge. So they can be a very good flag. Now, the problem is, because you're still not as far down in the edge as you need to be, you'll tend to go, well, I don't need to. And actually, you kind of need to listen.
I mean, presumably a lot of things that are stressing people out and getting to the point of burnout, you might not actually have that much control over.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it is very difficult. You know, jobs and things like that can be very problematic. There's a useful technique that I've sort of been trying to work with, which, can I just bore you slightly with a study for 2 minutes?
Go for it.
It was great. It's one of my favorite studies. It was done by a guy called Amos Tversky, who was Danny Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, is his research partner. But it was him and a guy called Shfir. And what they did was they looked at students about to take an exam. So it was quite a stressful exam.
We're in exam season now, interestingly. So
yeah. So, well, this might be relevant. So what they did was they randomized them into three groups. You've got three groups that are kind of equal. And one group, they said, if you pass the exam, would you like to go on a reduced price holiday to Hawaii? Very nice.
Sounds good.
Yep. About 65% of people said yes. Okay, second group, they said, if you fail the exam, would you like to go on a reduced price holiday to Hawaii?
Right.
And the result was about 65% of people said yes. They said, you know, it would cheer me up. The third group was interesting. They said, would you like to go on a reduced price holiday to Hawaii after the exam? And suddenly,
interest,
it drops right down to about 25%. Now, what's really interesting about this is there are only two possible outcomes to the exam, and you are going to go and do the same thing either way. But the moment this lump of uncertainty sits on the road in front of us, it stresses us out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things with exams, dare I say it, is, you know, what are the outcomes? I could pass. If I pass, I'm going to do this. I could fail. If I fail, I'm going to do that. You know, and we tend to kind of not want to crystallize.
Totally.
It.
And this is me when you're talking about your tells. I'll wake up and my brain's like, and instead of taking a moment to identify, okay, I've got X number of things to do.
Yeah.
And if I don't do this, this is the consequence. If I do this, then this is going to, we catastrophize and we spiral.
Absolutely.
And by kind of pressing that pause button and going, actually, what's at the root of this? And how bad could it be? Or how good could it be? That's, can lower the cortisol, hopefully.
Well, I think so. We haven't done the work actually looking at cortisol levels, but there is data around there. There are data around this. one of the things I think with those kinds of situations is, yeah, we tend to catastrophize. There's some interesting research looking at having a plan. Mm-hmm. So if you know when you wake up in the middle of the night and you're really worried about something and you think, God, I've got to solve this. Actually, you don't have to solve it. You don't have to solve it there and then. But just having a plan for how you're going to solve it is enough.
That's so interesting. So you don't need to get there. It's a case of feeling like you're empowered that you might be on the path to get there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's enough.
Yeah. So I've got to have a sticky conversation with someone when I get back to London, right? And it was stressful. But I thought, you know what? I'm going to speak to... I woke up in the middle of the night, was worrying about it. And I thought, you know what? Here's the plan. I'm going to talk to so-and-so. Check that I'm on the right lines there. Then I'll go and have the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that immediately drained away that uncertainty. And we catastrophize about things. What if I lose my job? What if you lose your job? They're not going to take you out and shoot you. You know, you go and get another job.
Please write a book, Ben, please.
It's really important because we worry about companies going bankrupt. Companies go bankrupt all the time. They don't take the employees out and shoot them. They get employed doing other things. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend who was fired from one of the banks, and one of the best things that ever happened to him. You know, and he will acknowledge that now. It didn't feel like it at the time.
But perspective-wise, yeah. Thank you so much for coming in and shedding some light on it. Really fascinating. I've had a message going, any recommended reading? You mentioned a book just there, but if anyone wants to explore the topic of stress, of burnout, whether they want to get super into studies and science nerdery or just some things that they'll be able to apply, anything that you really like to recommend?
Yeah, so there's a nice book by my old boss, which has got a slightly obscure title of The Hour Between Dog and Wolf. The Hour Between Dog and Wolf.
Okay, I'm going to give
John
it a Google.
Coates.
What's the gist?
And he really, he's the trader who set up all this stuff to begin with. So he was a trader at Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs. And during the dot-com boom, he became convinced that his colleagues had gone slightly off the rails.
It refers to the moment of Jekyll and Hyde transformation.
Exactly.
That traders pass through when under pressure. So it's about risk taking.
Yeah.
This sounds really fascinating. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Really, really appreciate it. And Master's going, super interesting topic. Really, really interesting message here saying, I needed to hear this today. Ben Hardy, really can't thank you enough for your time. That Cigna 360 Wellbeing Report is around if you want to do some further reading. And hopefully this conversation hasn't stressed you out. Helen Farmer with you live until 5. Do you know what globophobia is? Apparently fear of balloons. I reckon that's more common than you might think. What about vestophobia? Something I definitely don't have. Fear of clothing. Now, both of these might sound funny to many people listening today, but phobias come in all shapes and sizes and they can be absolutely debilitating. But what is a phobia? Where does it stem from? How can we overcome them? Joining us now is Joanna Richmond, a therapist and relationship counsellor from cbtdubai.com. Joanna, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Helen. How are you?
I'm well, except it's obviously got me thinking about my phobias.
Well, I was going to ask you, what are your phobias?
I don't love bats, to be honest. And this is going to sound really odd, but I'm sure you've heard it all. It started as a phobia, now it's a very strong dislike to bananas. I really, really, really hate them. And interestingly, I can pinpoint where I think it started. And that's because I used to get tonsillitis a lot as a child. And the penicillin medicine was banana flavoured. And it used to make me gag and I hated it. Now, any parents listening today will know that when you have a baby and you start weaning them, bananas are popping up everywhere. So I think I've had inadvertently done some exposure therapy. And while you'd have to pay me a significant amount of money to actually eat one, I can now be in the same room as a banana, which isn't,
really?
Which isn't something I ever thought I would be able to do. So thank you for not judging me on that weirdness. Bats and bananas. And we've got lots of messages coming in on this, Joanna. So I'm curious, first of all, to understand what a phobia is. How do you define it? And can you give us some of those parameters?
Yes, look, a phobia is an idea. It's a symbol. It's used as a defense mechanism to avoid reliving a prior psychological experience. So this would be you taking the medicine, having tonsillitis, that horrible feeling or that fear of ever having tonsillitis again and having to take medicine. Anything can become a phobia without giving a clue to its source. You happen to know your source. However, most people have a phobia, and it's to eliminate the possibility of anxiety and panic attacks.
So it's self-protection then?
Exactly. And it gives total control for the person. People with anxiety about anything, or people just with anxiety, they like to control their environment. Mm-hmm. They like to control everything around them. So, you know, you saying, no, I don't want to be anywhere near bananas. I don't want to see one. Don't even speak about it. That's you controlling your environment so you don't have that awful feeling of anxiety. Any object can become a phobia.
How does it differ from a fear or even a strong dislike? We know what might happen in the body that would tip something into being a phobia.
Well, therefore, we're going then into the autonomic nervous system. A fear, it arises from the sympathetic nervous system. And that goes up to the amygdala, which is our fear. And when that is raised, and that is something that when we're see something in front of us that frightens us, then that goes up. Now, to eliminate that, we have the parasympathetic nervous system, which we use breathing techniques to calm the person down so that they don't feel that anxiety. So it arises from a memory. Remember, the phobia is only a symbol. Mm-hmm. And it can cause sufficient anxiety for that person to avoid a situation, avoiding a lift. It doesn't mean somebody has had a terrible experience in a lift. It just, that lift has just become a symbol of fear. Now, that could be of confined places as a child, but they don't necessarily know the source of what is the what has caused this phobia.
Which then kind of begs the question, how on earth do you start to address it, which is what we're going to be talking about next. Joanna, before we do start to talk about solutions therapies, what are some of the most common types of phobias that you see in patients, or even when you start to tell people at a dinner party that you work with phobias that people come to you with? What are some of the biggies?
Well, acrophobia, fear of heights. These are very common. Allurophobia, fear of cats. Agoraphobia, fear of being outside. Arachnophobia, fear of spiders. These are very common ones. Anthropophobia is a fear of people or society. So that would be going out in crowds. Mm-hmm. And there's another one, attichophobia, which is fear of failure.
Wow.
And all of these things are, you know, are based on anxiety. It really is anxiety at the bottom of it. And in treatment, we have to look at the anxiety, which we will come to a little bit later.
Thank you. Joanna Richmond with us this afternoon as we talk about phobias. Joining us now from cbtdubai.com is Joanna Richmond. She's a therapist, a relationship counsellor, and we're talking about phobias. Really interesting to get your thoughts on these, guys. Joanna, I need to ask you, do you have any phobias?
I have arachnophobia. I'm terrified of spiders. Can't even look at a photograph in a book. I just feel I have to walk away. I can't look at it.
So why haven't you treated yourself or asked a colleague to help you deal with this phobia?
Well, I haven't found the need because I don't come across very many spiders. You know, I once had a spider on the wall and I had to ask somebody walking down the street to please come and remove the spider from my house because I couldn't go in the front door once I saw the, you know, with a big tarantula. I mean, it was huge.
Huge, of course, not just a little guy. Life-threatening. I wanted to ask you, John, about management of phobias. You know, can you ever be completely cured? Or is it about managing some of the symptoms and your reactions to a trigger?
Well, yes, it can. I mean, the bottom line is a phobia is symbolic. That means that person is having anxiety. So it would be finding out where the anxiety has come from. You see, a phobia is very different from post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. A phobia is symbolic. It's not real. It's imaginary. So somebody who's getting in a lift and is frightened of getting into a lift, it doesn't mean that they've had a dreadful experience in a lift. It just means that they are protecting, they're using the lift as a symbol to protect themselves from anxiety and the discomfort. So what we are looking at then to treat a phobia is finding the anxiety. Now, these phobias develop when children are young. fear of heights. Mm-hmm. A parent has said to the child, be careful when you're going down the stairs. Oh, you might fall. Oh, now be careful there. And that child has then developed a phobia about stairs. They grow up of heights. Then they can't go on a balcony. I might fall off the balcony. They've never fallen off a balcony. Mm-hmm. And they probably never even fell down the stairs. But the parents' anxiety was contagious. It's a learned behavior. Mm-hmm. They've had a fear of heights that they might fall. So therefore, it is going back into the anxiety, where this might have come from. Now, the source isn't necessarily prevalent. The person may not remember the source, but the fear has remained.
I'm just conscious that we're going to run out of time, and I've got lots of messages for you, Joanna. So let's talk treatment then. If someone has decided, do you know what? And let's use Carmen as an example, who shares your fear of spiders. She's saying it's hardcore. I can't get near them. I've had panic attacks. Last week, saw a massive spider at home and involved a lot of hyperventilating. I can't go on like this. What can I do? When it has become something that affects your day-to-day, the way you navigate the world, what happens if someone comes to you and says, enough's enough?
They're terrified of spiders.
Yes.
Well, I mean, there are options. I mean, I think exposure therapy might be too dramatic for somebody who's scared of spiders. And that would be, having a real spider crawling along the floor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we're going to do that. But cognitive behavior therapy, which is correcting the thinking by finding an alternative way of looking at the same situation. So if we're looking at spiders, thinking about spiders, and we do written work in cognitive behavior therapy. So we write down all of the negative thoughts. What is the fear of that spider? That spider is going to jump off the wall and jump on your head or something like that? What is it? And we write those down, and then we find another way. What is the likelihood of that spider jumping off the wall and diving on your head? Mm. Well, it's not really going to. It's more likely to run away, isn't it? So when we start changing our thinking about something, our feelings change.
So it's about attaching different, maybe not even attaching different meanings, but even attaching a kind of neutrality around something that has been, really, really impactful. Olivia came to us with asking about driving. She said, I used to be a confident driver, but now can't bear the thought of getting behind the wheel. We moved to Dubai. I wanted to get taxis for the first few months, but it's been over a year now. Major highways terrify me. It's really debilitating, and I want to get back to how I was all those years ago. So for Olivia, it is driving. What would you advise in that situation? Because, I don't know. Is it exposure therapy of, sitting behind the wheel in a parked car or, going to a small...
Indeed, yeah.
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I mean, that would be the first step, would be sitting in the car and turning on the engine and being in the car park. But again... What's happened here? Why has she got this fear? Where did it come from? Did she have a dreadful accident in her home country? That would make it post-traumatic stress if there was a dreadful, dreadful accident, and that is treated somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. But if it's a phobia, if she hasn't really had an accident, but she's just got a thing about it, she's arrived in Dubai now, I'm really scared to drive a car. Well, then again, we would be analysing the situation. What are her fears, and how can we correct them? Again, cognitive behavior therapy is very good for that because CBT works in the here and now. What are you thinking about that? Okay, can you see that is a negative feelings are arising in you by thinking that way? Let's look at another way of looking at it. It's not positive thinking. It's an alternative way of thinking about something. So it's still very real. So I would advise her to seek CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. I think that also she needs to do some deep breathing exercises before she gets into the car and switches on the engine, feels it, puts her feet on the pedal, and even just moving the car out of the car park if she can get that far. And then it's just trying to go some back streets. But I'm not sure of where this has come from or if she even knows.
Maybe she doesn't. And do you know what? I think a lot of people identify with this idea of putting something off, and it builds in your mind to be a bigger deal than the reality actually might be.
Exactly.
And you have this kind of attached perception of it's going to be terrifying. And don't get me wrong, Alkale can be terrifying. Oh, it has its moments. But by feeling supported emotionally, that must make a huge, huge difference. Joanna, we've run out of time, unfortunately, but it's been really fascinating to hear about some of the unlocking you can do, and also from everyone getting in touch about their phobias. We've had everything from low-flying birds to the ball pit in a kid's playground. So it just goes to show there's, you know, big, small, rational and irrational. It takes all sorts, but there are solutions out there if this is something that really is holding you back.
Definitely. And I'd advise getting treatment as soon as possible, because psychological problems can get worse with age. So I would suggest getting treatment.
Thank you so much for your time, Joanna.
My pleasure.
I'm very happy to share your details. If anyone wants to get in touch, you can just say therapy to me if you want on 4001, and I will send you the website for Joanna Richmond. Today is World Africa Day, and one lady who is celebrating the day with purpose is Nana Mansell. She is the founder of the West African food company Vegana. She's also created a homegrown fashion brand called Caped Coast. It's dedicated to sustainability, raising positive awareness around Africa, and also looking pretty fabulous, I have to say. Nana, how are you? And happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm great.
Thank you so much for being with us, especially on your special day. Can I ask you then, what does World Africa Day mean to you? And why do you feel like it's significant for it to be celebrated?
So actually, it's the day to celebrate African unity. It's the founding day of the Organization of African Unity, and which was founded in 1963, which very much hasn't happened. And why I've decided to make it my kind of life mission to remind us all about this date and get us to celebrate it is because definitely there's so much potential in Africa in all sorts of ways. And if we unified and make our voices loud and, you know, organized ourselves better, we have potential to change the world. And I believe this totally. Yeah. And it drives what I do.
Well, it drives very much what you do, from food, which we've talked about on the show, to fashion now. And I have to say, Expo for me was actually an incredible moment. Going to Alkibilan African Dining Hall was unbelievable. I felt like I learned so much, and perhaps had some misconceptions corrected as well, because I kind of thought, well, it's all, you know, African food is African food. But I started to realise, and I still only really scratched the surface, just some of the cultural and geographical differences, influences. And I wondered if you feel like there has been a raise in awareness and profile and a passion for Africa over the last few years.
There definitely has been. And just take music. I mean, when I was young in nightclubs, even in Ghana, where I'm from, it was all American rap music and, say, British pop. And now when you go to Ghana, it's all our own music. And not just is this music being played there, but it's being played around the world. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the first time when I was in Dubai, when I heard, you know, a song in my own language, which is, you know, such a tiny language. In a posh venue in Dubai, and I thought, my God, the world has changed.
Got goosebumps here.
Yeah, yeah. And this music now, Afrobeats, is all around us. And Dubai, the trade between Dubai and Africa in my time here has gone up, you know, exponentially. It's a lot. And you know, we have the big Africa Festival, so it's celebrated by thousands in October. So yeah, there's
it's
much
all
that's
happening.
Changed.
You're very much there at the forefront of that, Nana. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to start your food brand, first of all, before we move on to the fabulous fabrics that you brought into the studio this afternoon. Tell us a little bit about Vegana.
So my food brand started, actually, I was looking for a niche to do what I do. So I thought doing vegan West African food was the answer, because I know I'd been cooking it for vegan vegetarian friends. I wasn't vegan at the time myself. So I knew we had so much to offer. So, you know, COVID came, lost job, what to do? So I started that business. And then I realized, wow, I really am onto something, because there's so much variety. And even myself, I've only just begun to scratch the surface of, you know, the potential of plant-based African foods. And not only is it tasty, but the more I look into it, it's also, you know, the answer to a lot of our, you know, how to solve our climate problems, because some of the foods actually regenerate the soil as it grows. Some of it is also food that we know is ultra next level healthy, you know, for our bodies, and also tasty. So it's like, it's win, win, win.
We should say, you brought some in last time, and Poonam and I were like, not really sure what to expect here. And then ended up raving about it to each other and then anyone would listen. So thank you for opening our eyes and palates to that.
Absolutely, yes. And yeah, it's one thing I can kind of confidently boast in and know that if anybody tries our food, they're going to be impressed. And yeah, it's very nice.
Good.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's food that's also about the history of Africa, because there's all sorts of influences in there. European being Portuguese, French, even we've even had the Danish and Swedes going through Ghana. Of course, Arabic. And then, you know, with the slaves that went to across South and Southern America, and then brought also back again with some of the freed slaves. So it really is the food of the world, which is why so many people like it.
Can we talk about what you're wearing?
Yes. So I'm always bright. Yes. So are. I'm wearing something for my brand Cape Coast, which I actually started after I got into the food business. And I, you know, I'm a little bit vain, I won't lie. And just looked at that hairnet and it almost stopped me. I thought, I can't wear that. Come on, look at it. So I started to...
You were solving your own problem.
Yes. And I have this, you know, I have this mad curly hair. So I started putting this big head wrap on my head. And, you know, the chefs, because kitchens are very, very, you know, they have to save, clean, tidy, everybody in uniforms, looked at me and couldn't actually fault me on their, you know, this big, very colourful turban.
Functional yes. And fashionable. So... Yeah. This is, you know, started off as being a hairnet replacement. It's now something that's so much more than that, so much more meaningful on a global scale. Tell us a little bit about your mission with Cape Coast.
So my mission with Cape Coast is very, very deep. So even if you start with the name, I make capes, and the idea of the capes is that to get us away from how bound we are by fashion. Fashion just exaggerates the inequalities. It's, you know, for women, for men, you know, you look around at all the men wearing ties and shirts, and, you know, if we go home and change into something comfy, then why aren't we wearing something comfy all day? What we need to do is then make the comfy stylish. Not the other way around.
I love this.
Yeah.
It is very stylish. I mean, some of the colours, the pattern used, but you've also got some different techniques as well when it comes to those fabrics. Could you tell us a little bit about what you brought in?
Yeah, so I started Cape Coast just making these colourful things that I could throw to match my head wrap. And then I kind of then developed a philosophy, which was like, let's everything be good for the earth, be one size, unisex, and something you can wear, you know, wear for everything. And as I was on this journey in researching African fabrics, I came across Bogaland, also known as Mali mud cloth, which I'm now very fond of and make capes out of them. And my little mud cloth the method is about 300 years old and made from mud and dyes made from plants and tree barks.
Wow.
And each piece is individual because it's all handmade. So because each piece is individual, when you get it and you know there's not another.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is everything unique?
Everything's a one-off. So that comes back to the sustainability message. Because if you're buying something that there's only one of, you're more inclined not to throw it away.
That's so true.
You're more inclined to, and when you're choosing it also, you're not just going to come back and choose another one in a different size or different color. There's not going to be. It's not going to be here soon. So the idea is you buy something and then you treasure it, much like, you know, in every country, you know, our grandmothers would have sewn, knitted and made clothes. And then you'd
do and mend.
Yeah. And then we all pass that sort of outfit down for our babies and that sort of thing. But why, you know, that's the sort of thing we should be buying. And at the moment, we just put in our heads that sort of thing that's exclusive is only very expensive. Mm. But actually, it's not. And and designers like me are very much out there to say, buy that one special thing that's made for you in colours that you like and then treasure it. Yeah.
I want to ask you, Nana, about sourcing those fabrics. Have you had the opportunity to travel around and then bring these treasures back to Dubai? How has it worked?
Very much so. I'm in a blessed place of travelling back and forth from Ghana. To do with food and sort of activism about food. And so when I was there, I started buying the fabric for the head wraps, as I started saying, which would only be 2 yards, but some of this is sold in bigger bales. So then I started meeting people in the markets and really getting into fabric and how it got here and purposely trying to avoid, our African markets are flooded with replicas of African fabric from China. And so purposely try to avoid those and going towards things that are designed and produced locally in African fabrics, which has also taken me down the journey of then going away from things made in factories to things made traditionally, which is, you know, which is where I want to go.
I have some comments on the text line. One saying, she has a lovely voice. I couldn't agree more. And another saying, how to buy, where to find, which is my final question to you, Nana. So you are on Instagram at @caped_coast. You can have a look there. I'm hoping that I'll get the chance to try one on in the news.
Absolutely. And then you can, they suit everyone. So yes,
and
absolutely.
In terms of, and I think it's actually really important to see things in real life and to feel and to talk about it. So how can people come and get their hands on and learn more about your products?
So you can come and touch our products at Voco Hotel. We're on the first floor at the Deck Restaurant, and it's a beautiful space with, you know, views of the sea, and it's West Palm with parking. Those of you who know, you know.
Yeah, I saw a tweet the other day. I was like, do you get anxious about going anywhere? We don't know the parking, or are you normal? I was like, no. Valet parking is one of the main reasons I live in Dubai, and provided parking takes the load off. So thank you for acknowledging that.
Yes.
And what's next then? What is there going to be? Is it collections or how does it work?
So my ambitions are huge, of course.
Of course.
And all my clothes have yellow pockets because I believe we're all different shapes and sizes on the outside, but inside we're all deep and yellow.
Oh,
so I make these deep yellow pockets, and I hope soon all of Dubai will wave their yellow pockets at each other.
I love this. We've had a message saying I would love to connect with Nana, so I will connect you separately. In the meantime, though, if you want to find out more about these beautiful items, and again, happy World Africa Day. Mama Africa, there's nowhere like it. We can find out more at caped_coast. Nana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You are an absolute ray of sunshine. If you want information, you can just send me the word Africa. I'd be very happy to send over that Instagram so you can find out more. Talking health on the show this afternoon, and one particular treatment known as hyperbaric oxygen therapy involves the breathing of 100% pure oxygen in a pressurized suite. It's often called a chamber. And this increases oxygen levels in the body up to 20 times higher than normal. What are the benefits? We're finding out now with Professor Efrati, the co-founder of Aviv Clinics here in Dubai. How are you, Professor?
Hi.
Good to have you with us. I'm so interested in this because I had a tour of your facility when you first opened and it completely blew my mind. It was like being in the future, and the application sounded really fascinating. So I wanted to get you on to kind of explore a little bit further about how this can be helping all sorts of different people. I'd love to go back in time a little bit and find out how it was discovered originally and how it works. Can you explain for us in perhaps non-expert terms, if you don't mind?
I will do my best. So actually, it's all related to the brain and our insight that the brain is a tissue. And it started something like 20 years ago when we realized that there are stem cells in the brain, neuronal stem cells in the brain that can replicate, that can migrate, and that neurons in the brain are always being generated. And actually, the brain tissue is changing all the time. So the brain we're speaking with you now actually was not in medical school. So when we figure out that there is an ability to regenerate brain tissue, then the next step was to think what is the best way to do it, how we can induce this regeneration process. And for that, we are using a combination of oxygen and pressure. We are using the pressure in order to significantly increase the amount of oxygen that is being delivered to the body, because oxygen is a gas and the pressure enables us to compress more molecules per square that are going into the lungs and from the lungs to the rest of the body. And increasing the oxygen is not enough. What we are doing is a kind of trick, meaning when the people are in the chambers, in the suites, that's how we call them, then we are doing fluctuation. We are going from very, very high oxygen back to the normal. And this decline from very high back to the normal is being interpreted at the cellular level as hypoxia, as lack of oxygen.
Okay.
And this fluctuation actually triggers the regenerative, the repairs mechanism in the brain. And by doing that, we can repair and regenerate damaged brain tissue. So it's not the oxygen, it's the fluctuation that we generate.
So you create this fluctuation that makes the body react in a certain way, which then has these positive impacts. Now, it's obviously a treatment for the privileged few, if we're being honest, but I'm curious in terms of the conditions that you're able to help with, because I've heard that anti-aging, dementia, Alzheimer's, even physical conditions as well. What are you treating there at Aviv? Can you explain a little bit about what's coming into clinic?
Yes. So when we started with classical, the research, we started with classical indication like stroke, like traumatic brain injury, mechanical injury to the brain. And before taking somebody into the treatment, we are doing high resolution brain imaging that enable us to see the nerve fibers, the metabolism at the cellular level, as well as the small blood vessels. Based on this, we can define if we can see a wound that can gain benefit from the treatment, a type of injury that can gain benefit from the treatment. So if we see that, then the person is suitable. And more than that, when we are looking at the brain imaging, this high resolution brain imaging that now you have in Dubai, you have the most advanced MRI located in the Aviv clinic in Dubai. So when we're using that, we can decide if the person is suitable, if he can benefit, in what way he can benefit. And by doing that, we can set the expectation with the individual. So we started with stroke. We have done traumatic brain injuries. And then we move forward to what is the number one threat to our Western society, which is age-related cognitive and functional decline. So at the end of this decline, we can say there is Alzheimer or dementia, but Alzheimer or dementia are too late because there is nothing to save, there's nothing to repair anymore. So we are treating MCI, the age-related cognitive decline, the starting in the reduction of declining the short memory. You know, when you're looking for a word, you need to pick it up. That's how it starts. Mm-hmm. So we know today that Alzheimer's starts 25 years early before we can actually see the symptoms. So anybody who is having a cognitive decline that is related to age, he's invited first for evaluation. And if we can see the damage, it's better to repair it then. So you can
be really preemptive there, up to 25 years. And some of these conditions are indeed, genetic, hereditary. So there is some kind of blueprint that this might be something that you could be struggling with. I know you've also treated things like trauma and injuries as well. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
So today, and this is you hearing from me, I'm dealing with physiology. So if you would come to me 20 years ago, tell you I'm not dealing with emotional issue. This is my wife. She's a social worker. But today we understand that severe emotional stress can cause damage to the brain that is not less, in some cases, even more severe than mechanical injury. So we can see the fingerprint of the biological damage that can happen with stress. And again, if we see the wound, if we see the damaged brain tissue, and it's a tissue that can be repaired, the type of wound that can be repaired with our treatment, we will move forward. And this is, again, that's the core. You are looking at the brain, you see the wound in high-resolution MRI with perfusion and functional and DTI, and if you see the damage, you can repair it.
Can I ask then, we've had a number of messages about how it works in practice. So are you able to describe the space where the treatment takes place and what happens in that time, Professor?
So first of all, we are speaking now to, I believe, the general audience in Dubai. So we all do checkups, annual checkups, or most of us do annual checkups, which include blood samples, colonoscopy, mammography, depends what you have. Very few are doing, it's part of their annual checkup, brain evaluation. And the brain is the most important organ that we have in our body. Mm-hmm. So irrespective of whether you're getting the treatment, yes or not, I will highly suggest that people will come to evaluate the brain, see what's going on, see if we can see a damage that is moving forward. And if you have high risk of dementia, of Alzheimer's, and of course, we are doing also DNA analysis for those who need that, then based on this, you can continue monitoring. If at a certain point we see a decline, we can tackle that. And if not, just monitor. If it's an insult, like stroke, like traumatic brain injury, then you're coming to evaluation to see whether you can gain benefit from the treatment. After you have been through the baseline evaluation that includes brain imaging, cognitive evaluation, physiological evaluation, full DNA analysis, if you are suitable, you are moving to the treatment. It's not a magic. It takes time. With each session, we are triggering additional stem cells. We are gaining additional regenerative capacity. So the whole treatment includes 60 sessions. It's
60. Wow. Over how many weeks?
It's 2 weeks each session, 2 hours each session, and it's 5 days per week. It
wow.
means that
that's a commitment.
People need to be committed on a daily basis for 3 months. Yes, it's a commitment. It's just like a wound that needs to recover. It's not a magic. It doesn't happen in one day. And then after the treatment, you are having reevaluation to see objectively the change that happened in your brain.
Mm-hmm. We've had a question of asking how much, and I also wanted to know the answer to that. I don't know if we're able to share that, Professor, but I think it's good information for anyone who might want to be committing to that 12-week 60-session program. Can you give us a ballpark figure?
The cost is not me. You can get it from the clinic. I'm a physician and professor. So I don't want to make mistakes with regard to how much each of the
parameters. Not a problem. To those who are asking.
People can just log on and call Aviv Clinic Dubai and get all the information, the technical information needed.
Well, it's really fascinating that this is happening just minutes away from the studio. As I said, I've been to the facility. It is like being in the future to see people in this chamber, you know, sitting and chatting. And I'd be really interested to chat with one of your patients at some point as well, Professor, if we could get that organised. I think it'd be really fascinating. Thank you for your time and let you get back to your very busy day. And if you want details, you're more than welcome. You can just say oxygen on 4001 and I will send you the link. Aviv Clinics is in JLT. I've just been speaking there to the co-founder, Professor Efrati. My goodness, Alzheimer's, dementia, but we didn't even talk about concussion and some of the benefits that athletes are seeing as well. So if you do want details of that, you can send me the word oxygen and I will send that your way. For many UAE families, having a nanny is part of life, but it might not be a relationship or a dynamic that you used to. Maybe this is the first time you've had someone living in and working in your home. Larissa Smith from the Nanny Institute is joining us now to explore how you can work with your right-hand woman to be the best possible employer and develop her skills as well. We're going to be addressing teamwork, being on the same page, and some of the practical stuff too. Thank you so much for being with us, Larissa. I really, really appreciate it. I find this quite an emotional topic. And I say this because I'm so grateful to our nanny, Loretta, who has been with us for 8.5 years now, I work it out.
And definitely nannies are a big role in our lives. They are our village because we don't have family here and they really play a vital role.
They really do.
For us.
And, you know, when I look at different Facebook groups, it also tends to be a great source of stress for a lot of families because I say this knowing just how privileged I am to have found a woman as amazing as Loretta to be part of our lives. And she's the reason I'm able to be here this afternoon. She's the reason I was able to go into work with confidence a few months after my baby was born. And she genuinely is someone I am so, so grateful for every single day. So I know how lucky I am, and I know a lot of people aren't that lucky, and I know that there's a lot of obstacles and stumbling blocks along the way. So you're a former nanny yourself. You work with children in nurseries as well. But with the Nanny Institute, what's your mission Larissa?
So basically, we want to support parents and nannies with a well-researched and affordable program. We feel that nannies don't always have the funds to go for training before they take on a job. Mm-hmm. And parents also don't always have that extra money to spend on nanny training. So we wanted to make it affordable training, and we want to cover all areas from safety till educational concepts to make sure we're actually supporting. We actually have a nanny support group where nannies can ask questions, and we actually answer them, support them wherever we can with it.
I think that's a really important aspect, because sometimes it can be a bit of a confidence gap as well as a education gap. You know, you might meet someone that you really love, but they might not have necessarily the skills that you need. So you're closing that. And then equally, as you say, there might be a nanny who's maybe new to the country or younger or has changed careers, and she wants to do the best possible job, but maybe needs the tools to get there.
Yeah, and the same goes for safety. A lot of times we are all safety trained, we have the knowledge, but we've never actually been in that situation. And then when you're exposed to it, you don't know what to do, mm-hmm. and you don't know how to deal with it. So we try to walk nannies through emergency situations and how to respond, and giving them the confidence to actually respond well.
We are going to be talking a little bit about some of the issues that people are coming up against, but also some solutions. And I think it's really important to celebrate the positive as well. So if you want to give a shout out to your right-hand woman, you're more than welcome to reach out. Equally, if you are struggling with anything in this area, feel free. Can I ask then, what are some of the biggest frustrations that you hear from employers? We'll start with.
I think a big role that is important is time management for the nanny and how to deal with all the different aspects. So we go into the homes, we have bespoke in-house training, and we teach the nannies how to throughout the day manage their tasks with looking after the children and always prioritizing the safety of the children, making sure children are safe, engaged in activities, and that they can get whatever they need to done.
Here's a tricky question. What if you go into that home and you're like, well, this workload's completely unrealistic. Like, this employer has got expectations far beyond what's possible on a day.
I'm really open with parents about it, because in the end, they contacted us to support them, mm-hmm. and we're here to solve problems. I'm really solution focused, and I always talk to them openly. We give them daily planners to support them to actually see, because I think once you write things down and you see the workload, you'll be like, this is too much.
Exactly. So it's about some really actionable, practical stuff as well. What about from the nannies? You say you've got a support group. What are some of the things that are commonly coming up from their side?
Definitely with nannies is their lack of knowledge. Sometimes that they're saying, when it comes to writing and homework and that, they don't know always how to approach it and how to encourage children to be excited about homework and after school.
Can you help me with that, please?
So that is one of the biggest things. And also nannies, I can always see when we do the workshops, it is a confidence. They need that confidence boost. They need that encouragement and that appraisals that they're doing really well in mm-hmm. what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. What about building trust? Because ultimately, you know, it's a strange one. You know, we met Loretta when I was pregnant, and it was a really nice segue into me going back to work after having a baby, because I didn't feel like she was coming in and kind of disrupting our routine. You know, we kind of built that routine together. But ultimately, you are having someone in your home, and it's very unusual to be living and working with somebody side by side. What are some of the things you can do to make sure that you're a good match and you're compatible and you get that trust?
So I always... it's similar than a husband and wife relationship.
Definitely.
It's a lot of work that you need to put into it. You need to talk about things. We talk a lot about background, where we come from, why we do certain things, and understanding why we're doing things. And once you understand why nannies are making certain decisions in the house and also why parents are making these decisions, mm-hmm. it's so much easier to get a combined approach to what we're doing.
Larissa Smith with us this afternoon from the Nanny Institute, KHJ licensed training for, I think it's really important, not just for nannies, but for parents as well. And you do workshops where people come together, is that right?
Yes, so we have a mom and nanny workshop or a parent and nanny workshop where we talk about all these things. Even if it's a new nanny or a current nanny, we talk about all the different aspects that's important. It's sometimes easier when we come in as a third person to ask these questions, and it's mm-hmm. not always on the parents to ask.
Live in the studio now from KHJ licensed organisation, it's the Nanny Institute, Larissa Smith, the founder, and we're talking about how to really have the best possible relationship with your nanny, something that I think is not really talked about that openly, despite there being problems frequently on both sides. So I wanted to ask you about being a good employer, Larissa, because in Singapore, you need to undertake something called the Employers Orientation Programme. It's a 3-hour programme that helps you understand your roles and responsibilities as an employer. And I think that sounds fantastic, because I think a lot of people, as I said, this is their first experience of having someone helping in the home and kind of going into it blindly through no fault of their own. So when you're speaking to nannies and supporting them, what are some of the issues that, you know, we as employers can be addressing to really help them in the best possible way?
I think like any job, it's important to have some kind of job description and outline their jobs and responsibilities so they actually know what is expected and how to deal with it. And then one thing that I'm really a big fan of is open communication. Like we have parent-teacher meetings at school, we should have nanny and parent meetings maybe once or twice a week. Have a coffee, talk about it, talk about things, ask how the children are doing, and just keep that communication open. Mm-hmm. And that will make the nannies more comfortable to actually ask questions, ask for support. And also for the parents, it won't be a once-off, like you're in trouble kind of situation. It will just be more
an ongoing.
Let's sit and chat about things.
Which is exactly what Vinny was asking, saying how best to give feedback. Is an appraisal too formal? I mean, I certainly wouldn't say, you know, let's mark your calendar, you know, once a month for an hour long sit down. But maybe it is that of, you know, let's try and sit down for a cup of tea a couple of times a week.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Just say this is what's coming up and how best to kind of get on the same page. What I will say is that while we hear an awful lot of moaning from people about their nannies, I've heard some absolute horror stories from nannies about employers. Horrendous. In fact, the family that Loretta was with before us, I mean, it absolutely begged belief. She hadn't had her passport in 2 years. The hours were revolting, the way she was treated, disgusting, and it kind of really breaks my heart, to be honest.
And I think that's a big thing where their fear comes from, and that they're scared sometimes to ask for advice and ask for support. Mm-hmm. is because they are scared of losing their job. Mm-hmm. And creating that space where they're comfortable and where they feel safe is, yes, really important.
Thank you, Larissa. What about being on the same page in terms of, I don't want to say disciplining children, but certainly values when it comes to expectations of behaviour and responsibilities in the home? Because I think, for me, I hope we have empowered Loretta as much as possible, our nanny, to act on our behalf when we're not there.
Yeah.
What, tell us a little bit about that dynamic.
I think it's really important to model it yourself, whatever you would like to happen in your house, and be the example for the nanny and for the children. Mm-hmm. And it's important for nannies to understand that children do watch them and they do learn from them, and that they are the models that they look at. And that would influence their behavior totally, and thinking of it as their own children, but finding that balance that it is someone else's children and knowing their boundaries in that, but definitely modeling and supporting them.
A message that's come in on 4001 saying, we're having some issues with our nanny being on the phone all the time and don't know how to handle it. This is a tricky one, because ultimately, you're in a workplace, and are you on your phone all day when you're office? No, but our phone's part of day-to-day life in terms of staying in touch with, you know, friends and family and, you know, employer in that case. Are there any guidelines that, you know, has this come up in your discussions before?
So usually when we ask nannies, where should your phone be? And they're like, away. And then I'm like, how will you call the emergency services? You need your phone with you. But in the end, children are made for connection. Children need connection. And with a nanny being on the phone, children won't have that connection to grow and learn. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for the nanny in the house to understand what is the outcome of this and how this will influence the child in the rest of their life.
Can I ask though, when do you say, do you know what, there's a personality clash, or do you know what, I'm sure you're fantastic but you're not the right fit for our family? What are some of the steps that when you know, it might be the end of the road?
I think it's important to always reflect on what we're doing and how it's influencing the children. And then in the end, if it's not benefiting the children, then it is time to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. I would definitely work out like a plan to see how you can support the nanny maybe for 2 months, work out a weekly plan, kind of do check-ins and see how she's doing with it, and just give her the opportunity. And like I said, to always understand the reasons why they're doing things might give a clearer understanding.
Great question here. Wish I'd thought to ask this earlier. This is from H saying, when interviewing a nanny, what are some good questions to ask? Great great question.
Great.
So what are some of the things that you want to be connecting on and covering information-wise when you meet someone for the first time?
I think it's really important to look for a love for children and a passion for education, because that will in the end be what the children are getting from it. And I always want to foster a love for reading and for learning. And you need to find someone that has a love, because without that love and passion, it will definitely not work. And I do think it depends on personalities as well. You need to find someone that works in your family setting regarding personality. Some people are more quiet and some are more loud, and you need to find the balance of what's working for you. But some questions I really recommend, or some things, it's really doing background checks. What I've seen a lot, and also qualification checks. This is something that I've done a few times now, and it's really important to take those steps.
Speaking of qualifications, what's on the upcoming Nanny Institute calendar? So tell us a little bit about some of the workshops that you run, and is there anything planned, whether it's online or in real life, for the coming weeks and months?
Okay, so we have 5 different workshops. We have 4 for nannies, and then we have 1 for preschool assistants. So we have a comprehensive nanny training that's split up into 2 parts. We have a clever kitchen program where we help the nannies to pack lunch boxes, what is important with food, how to introduce solids. And then we also have the mom and nanny workshop. So this coming weekend, next weekend, we will have a workshop at Eggs and Soldiers for moms and nannies. Mm-hmm. And we've scheduled a few workshops at Jumeirah Golf Estate as well. And we will be launching some short workshops in the next week that will be online, tackling specific issues such as behavior, eating, and all of that.
I'm glad you mentioned eating there, because I was chatting with a friend the other day, and she was talking about, you know, the kind of, I heard this story. But we were talking about I don't know how to put it, kind of emotional neglect in kids, but also, I have to try and phrase this really carefully, and not allowing a child to be independent. So it was about a year 4 boy who couldn't feed himself because his nanny was always feeding him. And a message here saying, question for Larissa, how do you deal with a nanny that spoils your children? For example, my nanny will bring a glass of water to my child when he's watching TV, or will do my child's chores on their behalf and not tell the parents.
Definitely explain to her the influence on the type of adult he could become if he gets used to someone doing everything for them, because we want independent children.
Mm-hmm.
We are independent. I've been raised independent. And once you see what impact that can have and what type of adult they can become.
A useful one, hopefully.
Yes.
Anonymous matches here saying, we were surprised we moved here that nannies tend to be paid differently according to their nationality. Is this legal? What are the laws and practices around it? And this tends to be set by the embassy. Is that right?
So this is a touchy subject, getting into salaries and everything. But it is, I think it would be best to contact their specific embassy and make sure, because there is some things that people do and others don't, and there is not a specific guideline for it.
And I think, and I would also say, just because the law says something doesn't mean you can't do better, whether that is, you know, leave, salaries, hours, you know, whatever that might be. Because when you have that mutual, you know, respect, it just comes back in spades. And then people asking for your details, Larissa, what's the best way of getting in touch with you and finding out about some of those workshops and the resources that you have?
So our website is available. It's www.thenannymovement.ae. And then our Instagram is The Nanny Institute, where my contact details will be on to reach us.
If you're not able to grab that right now, send me, if you like the word nanny, I'd very happy to send you the link so you can check over there. Thank you so much. I think really important topics. And as I said, some that affect, you know, emotional, practical side of living here in the UAE. And it's great that there are some really safe hands, both on the parenting and the nanny front, to kind of guide us through that.
And just, I have one last step for nannies that I would really like to share is, and it's always to think, what can I do with what I've got? And you've been given a few things, maybe it's your character skills or even resources in the home. Mm-hmm. What can you do with what you've been given? And that hopefully motivates them.
That, and I think the fact that you're supporting nannies as well is really, really invaluable. So thank you for that. If you'd like more information, send me the word nanny. As I said, brilliant resources, workshops and more. Turning our attention to the environment now, and have you heard of the term greenwashing? It's basically when a company or a brand conveys a false impression, misleading information about how environmentally sound their products are. So they might say this shampoo is organic, but Probably isn't. It's full of parabens, but the branding says otherwise. Well, one young student is really passionate about this subject. Year 7 student Sean Ranciparo is from GEMS Cambridge International School in Abu Dhabi and was selected to have his audio blog on the subject of greenwashing published online by the Economist Educational Foundation. He is with us now. How are you, Sean?
I'm doing good today.
Fantastic to have you with us. I'm so impressed that, well, first of all, that you have a passion for the planet. And second of all, your knowledge of the terminology. I did not have a clue what greenwashing was, even a couple of years ago when I was in my 30s, never mind 12 years old. So where did your interest in this topic come from?
I wasn't really inspired to do it. It was actually like a lesson and it got me interested into it because of the many companies that I'm interested in that are actually helping the environment.
So for you, it's about making sure that we're clear about who is really doing something good for the planet and who is just claiming to. So it's about making sure that information is communicated properly. I understand that this started as a bit of a competition. Tell us about the origin of when you were looking at this with, as I said, the Economist Educational Foundation.
So technically, during my English class, my teacher, we were sponsored by a school and they asked us, you know, to join this competition. And I was like really excited to do it because I was very interested.
Tell us about the research that you've been doing into this topic. What have some of your big findings been, Sean?
So the way I see it, like if you would think that, oh, just the small companies would do this, no, really big companies can do that and just leave it and like forget about it. Like, according to beautypackaging.com, bbonline.com, and earth.org, companies like Mercedes, Volkswagen, and Coca-Cola have done it in the past.
Now,
it's really surprising.
I'd really like to kind of talk about maybe some of the watchwords, the phrases, even the numbers on packaging that we as consumers need to be looking out for in order to find products that really are doing what they say. Have you got any advice for us?
It would be to look at the choice of wording, because without explanation to why it's eco-friendly and stuff, the words will mean like nothing at all.
Mm-hmm. Which companies do you think are doing a good job in the fight against climate change?
To be honest, Lego, because usually if you were to open a Lego, it's my favorite. When you open a Lego set, they would come with these plastic bags and they're trying their best to change it into paper bags. And in one Lego set, they actually have the paper bags.
I think Lego is a really interesting example because, as you say, it's a plastic product in the packaging as well. But when I've spoken to Lego spokespeople and designers in the past, what they're really passionate about is reusing things as well. So it's not just, getting a set and making it, but breaking it down and using your imagination to use it in, infinity different ways and kind of applying that creativity. So that's a brilliant example. Now, UAE's hosting COP28 later on. Have you got any messages for listeners today, whether they are in school or older, about what we can do as consumers to have the planet front and center of our mind and priorities?
Yes, I do, actually. You have to help stop climate change in any way possible. Doesn't matter if it's a small or a big change. It will be a really big change in the future, as even though you do a small thing, like, for example, today I'm going to just put some plastic into the recycling area. In the future, that would be a really good thing.
And it's about understanding that together we have an impact, right? And it's easy to say, I'm just one person, that's never going to make a difference. But if everyone had that attitude, nothing would get done, we'd have no positive change. What about at school? Are there any initiatives or lessons that you've been seeing there to kind of really encourage you and your fellow students? What are you seeing around campus there?
Sometimes there are these boxes where if you have like a book here, you can just donate it here. Or if you have any plastic or unused paper, you can put it over here. They're also trying their best to help out as much as they can.
Well, again, congratulations on, yes, your amazing passion for this, but also the fact that your audio blog on this subject is now published online. Sean, all the very best to you and your family, all the best to you and the teams there at GEMS Cambridge International School in Abu Dhabi. You're an absolute superstar and I can't wait to see what you do in the future. Will you keep us posted when you're speaking at COP in a few years' time?
Yes, I will 100% do it.
Thank you. You're a star. Take care of yourself. Sean speaking to us, year seven student. Tell you what, though, guys, if you know a young person, really, really fascinating to share that. If there's any student out there who's doing something, whether it's academics or even charity or anything that you think we should hear their story, you can get in touch with me, 4001. You can get in touch with us there on the ARN Play app and the WhatsApp too. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.